Voices from Chernobyl, the oral history of a nuclear disaster. On April 26, 1986, the worst nuclear reactor accident in history occurred in Chernobyl, Ukraine, only 40 miles north of Kyiv, the capital, and a city of 3 million people. This accident contaminated as much as three-quarters of Europe. We will never know how many people died prematurely or how many children were born deformed as a result of this tragedy. Fortunately for the population of Kyiv, but unfortunately for the people of Belarus, the wind that day blew mostly to the north. Over 485 villages had to be abandoned forever. Even today, approximately 2.1 million people, including 700,000 children, live on contaminated land. The voices of those you will hear were survivors of Chernobyl, people who lived through this disaster and told their story to Svetlana Alexievich, a journalist who interviewed them. Many of these witnesses have already died. Lyudmila Ignatenko, wife of fireman Vasily Ignatenko.
We were newlyweds. We still walked around holding hands, even if we were going to the store. I would say to him, "I love you." But I didn't know then how much. I had no idea. We lived in Pripyat in the dormitory of the fire station where he worked on the second floor. There were three other young couples, and we all shared a kitchen on the first floor. They kept the trucks, the red fire trucks. One night I heard a noise. It was late, after midnight. I looked out the window, and he saw me. "Close the window and go back to sleep. There's a fire at the reactor. I'll be back soon." I didn't see the explosion itself, just the flames. Everything was bright, the whole sky. A tall flame and smoke. Oh, the heat was awful, even there at the firehouse. The smoke was from the burning bitumen that covered the roof. Later, he said it was like walking on tar. They tried to beat down the flames, kicked at the burning graphite with their feet. They weren't wearing protective clothing. No one told them. They'd been called for a fire. That was it. Hours went by. 4 o'clock. 5. 6. At 6, we were supposed to go to his parents' house, 25 miles away from here, to help them plant potatoes. 7 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, they told me he was in the hospital. I ran there, but the police weren't letting anyone in. Other wives of husbands who'd gone to put out the fire were there too, but none of us could get in, only ambulances. The police shouted, "The ambulances are radioactive, stay back." Finally, I saw a friend who was a doctor in that hospital. "Get me inside," I begged her. "I can't. He's bad. They all are." I held on to her, wouldn't let her go, just to see him. "All right," she said, "but just for 15 or 20 minutes. He was all swollen, like puffed up. You could barely see his eyes. "He needs milk, lots of milk," my friend the doctor said. "They should drink at least 3 liters a day, but he hates milk. He'll drink it now." We didn't know it then, but a lot of the doctors and nurses in that hospital, especially the orderlies, would get sick themselves and die. At 10 in the morning, the cameraman, Shishanok, died. He was the first. I said to my husband, "Vasya, what should I do?" "Get out of here. Go. Leave. Save our baby." "Well, first I need to bring you milk. Then we'll decide what to do." My friend Tanya comes running in. Her husband's in the same room. We go in her father's car to town, buy all the milk we can find, and come back. But they all started throwing up as soon as they drank it. They passed out. They got put on IVs. The doctors told them they'd been poisoned by gas. Nobody said anything about radiation. Only the military people wore surgical masks. They were all over town, closed off the roads, washed the streets with some white powder. That night, they wouldn't let any of us in the hospital. There was a sea of people. Vasya came to the window and yelled something. I couldn't hear what he said, but someone did. They were being taken to Moscow. All of us wives got together, decided we'd go with them. We punched, we clawed at the soldiers. Now it was the army all around, not the police. A doctor came out, said they were being flown to Moscow, but we need to bring clothes. The clothes they wore at the reactor had been burned. When we came running back with clothes, the plane was already gone. They tricked us.
Valentin Borisevich, physicist, former head, laboratory of the Institute of Nuclear Energy, Belarusian Academy of Sciences.
On that day, I came into work at the Institute, which was in a forest outside of Minsk. It was wonderful weather, spring. I opened the window. The air was fresh and clean, and I was surprised to see that, for some reason, the blue jays I'd been feeding all winter, hanging pieces of sausage out the window for them, weren't around. Had they found a better meal somewhere? In the meantime, there's panic at the reactor at the Institute. The dosimeter readings are up 200 times in the air cleaning filters. That's very serious. That level is the highest allowable during work in radioactively dangerous zones, for a maximum of 6 hours. The first theory was that a hermetic seal had broken on one of the heat-generating elements. We checked, and it was fine. At this point, the internal radio announces that workers are advised not to leave the building. The area between our separate buildings grows deserted. Not a single person. It was frightening and strange. The dosimetrists check my office. The desk is glowing. My clothes are glowing. The walls are glowing. I get up. I don't even want to sit in my chair. Is it possible there's an emergency at our institute? Some leak? And I was very proud of our reactor. I'd studied every millimeter of it. We call up the nearby Ingelinks nuclear plant. Their instruments are going crazy. They're also panicking. Then we call Chernobyl. Nobody answers. By lunchtime, we find out there's a radioactive cloud over all of Minsk. We determined the activity was iodine in nature. That means the accident was at the reactor.
I told my parents I had to go to Vasya in Moscow. My mother was crying. Where are you going, pregnant the way you are? So I took my father with me. He went to the bank and took out all the savings they had. I don't remember anything about the trip. In Moscow, we asked the first policeman we saw, where did they put the Chernobyl firemen? It was a state secret, but he told us. Hospital number 6. It was a special hospital for radiology. There, I had to bribe a woman at the door to get in. Finally, I get in the office of the head radiologist. Right away, she asked, do you have kids? I can see already that I need to hide that I'm pregnant, but I don't show yet. I have 2 children, I lie, a boy and a girl. Good. So you don't need to have any more. But listen, his central nervous system is completely compromised, and his skull. And listen, if you start crying, I'll kick you out. And absolutely no kissing or hugging. Don't you even go near him. You have 30 minutes. There are 28 of them who came on the plane, and they all want to know about their children or families in Pripyat, and I tell them the whole town is being evacuated. One woman in their group who had worked at the plant that day began crying, worried about her children. I met a lot of good people at that time. I remember one old woman janitor at the hospital. She taught me, there are sicknesses that can't be cured. You just have to sit and watch them. Vasya started to change. Every day I met a new person. The burns started to come to the surface. At first they were little lesions, and then they grew. His skin came off in layers. It's impossible to talk about this. I loved him so much. They told me 14 days. In 14 days, he will die.
Vasily Nestorenko, former director, Institute for Nuclear Energy at the Belarusian Academy of Sciences.
Someone's going to have to answer for Chernobyl. They're criminals. The time will come. It might be in 50 years. Everyone might be old. They might be dead. We need to leave the facts behind us. On that day, 26th of April, I was in Moscow on business. That's where I learned about the accident. I called Nikolai Shrumkov, General Secretary of the Belarus Communist Party. They wouldn't connect me to him. I reached his assistant, who knew me well. I'm calling from Moscow. Get me Shrumkov. I have information he needs to hear right away. Emergency information. I'm calling over a government line, and as soon as I start talking about the accident, the line goes dead. Even I was blocked. So I only hope the appropriate agency is listening. It took me 2 hours to reach Shlunkov. I've already received reports, says Shlunkov. There was a fire, but they put it out. I can't hold it in. That's a lie. Any physicist will tell you the graphite is burning at something like 5 tons per hour. Think of how long it's going to burn. I get on the first train to Minsk. In the morning, I'm home. I measure my son's thyroid. That was the ideal dosimeter then. It registered 180 microrentgens per hour. He needed potassium iodide. A child needed 2 to 3 drops and a glass of solvent. An adult needed 3 to 4. The reactor burned for 10 days. This should have been done for 10 days. But no one listened to us, the scientists, the doctors. On the 29th of April, I finally get into Shlunko's office, the reception area. They don't let me in. I'm trying to get in. Keep trying. I sit there till 5:30. At 5:30, a famous poet walks out of Shlunko's office. I know him. He says to me, Comrade Shlunkov and I discuss Belarus culture. I explode. There won't be any Belarus culture or anyone to read your damn books if we don't evacuate everyone from Chernobyl right away.
The hospital took away everything of mine, even my clothing, and gave me a robe. All my things were radioactive. My father, sister, and brother came to Moscow and brought me things. On the 9th of May, Victory Day from the war, Vasya asked me to open the window so he could see the fireworks. And then he pulled 3 red carnations from under his pillow and gave them to me. He'd given the nurse money, and she bought them. I ran over to him and kissed him. Later, I was in the hallway, and I got dizzy, and a doctor came by and took me by the arm. Then suddenly, are you pregnant? No, no. I was scared. Don't lie, he sighed. The next morning, the head doctor calls me to her office. Why did you lie to me, she says. There was no other way. If I'd told you, you'd send me home. It was a sacred lie. What have you done, she said. I was with him. All my life, I'll be grateful to that head doctor that she let me in. Other wives came, but they weren't let in. Only the mothers of the men. They were no longer fertile, wouldn't give birth. Vladya Pravik's mother sat with him the whole time, kept begging God, take me instead.
Sergei Soboilev, deputy head, executive committee of the Shield of Chernobyl.
I'm actually a professional rocketeer. I specialize in rocket fuel, served at Baikonur, our space launch center. It was a miraculous time. You give the people the sky, you give them space. Every person in the Soviet Union went into space with Yuri Gagarin. For family reasons, I moved to Belarus, finished my career here. When I came, I immersed myself into this Chernobylized space. It was a corrective to my sense of things. I'd always dealt with the most advanced technologies, but still it was impossible to imagine anything like this. We collect donations, visit the sick and dying. We write chronicles. We're creating a museum. Sometimes I think we have a funeral parlor here, not a museum. This morning, I haven't even taken off my coat. When a woman comes in, she's crying. Not even crying, but yelling. Take his medals and his certificates. Take all the benefits. Give me my husband. She yelled a long time and left his medals, his certificates. Well, they'll be in the museum on display. People can look at them, but her cry. No one heard her cry but me. And when I put these certificates on display, I'll remember it. Colonel Yaroshuk is dying now. He's a chemist, dosimetrist. He was healthy as a bull. Now he's lying paralyzed. His wife turns him over like a pillow. She feeds him from a spoon. He has stones in his kidneys that need to be shattered, but we don't have the money to pay for that kind of operation. We're paupers. We survive on what people give us. And the government behaves like a moneylender. It has forgotten these people. When he dies, they'll name a street after him, or a school, or a military unit, but that's only after he dies. Colonel Yaroshuk. He walked through the zone and marked the maximum points of radiation. They exploited him in the fullest sense of the term, like he was a robot. And he understood this, but he went. At the reactor, they tried using robots, machines, to put out the fire. But the radiation was too much for them. The robots couldn't function. So they had to send in men, human beings, soldiers. 210 military units were thrown at the liquidation of the fallout of the catastrophe. This equals about 340,000 men. The ones cleaning the roof had lead vests, but the radiation came from below, and they wore cheap, ordinary boots. They spent about 2 minutes on the roof each day, and then were discharged, given a certificate, and 100 rubles. They were all young guys. They're dying now, but they understood that if it weren't for them, they were a sacrifice. There was a moment when there existed the danger of a nuclear explosion, and the explosion would have been between 3 and 5 megatons. That would have meant not only Kiev and Minsk, but a large part of Europe would have become uninhabitable. Can you imagine it? A European catastrophe.
Finally, Vasya was in a special bio chamber, all behind a transparent curtain. No one was allowed inside. Through the curtain, they gave him shots and all. He got so bad I couldn't leave the room. He called for me constantly. Finally, the orderlies refused to work. They had soldiers wipe the walls and change the bedding. Then every day, someone died. Tishura is dead. Tetanyok is dead. Each death was like a sledgehammer to my brain. I remember someone saying, "You have to understand, this is not your husband anymore, but a radioactive object with a strong density of poisoning. You're not suicidal. Get a hold of yourself." But I remembered how at home he always took my hand and held it all night while he slept. So in the hospital, I take his hand. One night when we're all alone, he says, "I want to see our child so much." "What are we going to name our child?" I say. "You decide," he says. "Why me? There are two of us." "In that case, if it's a boy, he should be Vasya. And if it's a girl, Natasha." One day I walk into the hall and tell the nurse he's dying. "What did you expect? He got 1,600 Rentgen. 400 is a lethal dose. He's a nuclear reactor." When all the men had died, they redid the whole hospital, scraped the walls, dug up the parquet floors. One day I leave Vasya to go to the cemetery with Tanya for the burial of her man and another one. When I came back, the nurse said Vasya had died. "He called your name at the end. I told him you'd be right back." At the morgue, they dressed him in formal wear. But they had to cut up the shoes and uniform because they couldn't get him into it. His body was all swollen, distorted. At the end, pieces of his lungs and his liver were coming out of his mouth. And in this formal wear, they put him in a cellophane bag, then into a wooden coffin. They wrapped the coffin in another clear bag, and they told all of us it was impossible for us to take their bodies home. They said they are very radioactive and will be buried in a Moscow cemetery in sealed zinc caskets under cement tiles. All you need to do is sign this document here.
Finally, I get in to see Shlunkov and tell him we have to save these people, that in Ukraine they are already evacuating. He says, "Why are your men from the Institute running around with their meters, scaring everybody? I've already consulted with Moscow, with Professor Ilyin, chairman of the Soviet Radiological Protection Board." He says, "Everything is normal. We've thrown in the army, all our military equipment into the breach." Now, you should know, at Chernobyl, we had thousands of tons of cesium, iodine, lead, zirconium, cadmium, beryllium, borium, unknown amounts of plutonium, 450 types of radionuclides in all, equivalent to 350 atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima. I said to Shlunkov, who had been a director of a tractor factory, "When they call people to account, you're going to say you're a tractor specialist, that you didn't understand what radiation can do. But I'm a physicist. I know the consequences." But from his point of view, what was this? A bunch of physicists, some professors, were going to tell the Central Committee what to do? No, he and the others weren't a gang of criminals. It was a conspiracy of ignorance and obedience. The principle of their lives was never to stick their necks out. Their worst fear was a panic, and the truth would come out, and they'd lose their jobs. They just wanted to cover it up, all that had happened. Believe me, if we were still in the Soviet Union, still living in a closed system, people would still be living right next to Chernobyl.